while we have our chairs coming down.
Watch the drink here.
Perhaps we can just begin the beginning of the program. We'll just have a lengthy introduction, that's all. We'll introduce the introduction and then we'll introduce the next introduction. It's a great pleasure to welcome so many friends to Orizaba tonight. We have our Orizaba people, we have friends of Orizaba, we have actors and actresses, we have scholars, we have artists who have all been brought to our congregation this evening because of another wonderful opening. When we were envisioning this building, we had a lot of dreams that were in our hearts, but we never knew it would get into our heads. One of the dreams that some of us had was a dream that Orizaba could be a valuable gallery space on the Upper East Side, and that we would do it in our way to present scenes that grew out of our own congregation's life, that told our story. And that was a dream. But you really never know whether your dreams will ever be able to get to the threshold of reality. So much of that depends upon who people will be. And I don't have to tell you that this is a congregation of this. Some of the most amazing people you'll ever meet. They brought their friends. And anytime I'm here, I always learn from the people who are here. It's an endless, ongoing learning experience. One of the jewels of Orizaba is Bobby Kohler. You look around and you see an exhibit like this, you say, I don't really believe that anybody did this. They did it here. But the thing is, if you came to the last one, you said that already. If you came to the one before that, it's all packed. It's because Bobby Kohler brings her talent, her tremendous intellectual gifts, her professional expertise, her love of the community, of our people, into what she has given us as a repeating gift. I want to just take a moment to ask you to give a round of applause to Bobby Kohler. Also now, Bobby will say a few words about another one of these amazing people that has crossed our path, and that's Rudy Wolf.
Yes.
You are here. We were prepared for this evening by a year, about?
Almost a year.
Almost a year of enjoying Rudy Wolf's incredible expressions of Bereshit, which were the beauty of this room and this congregation for about a year. Part of the high degree of professionality which you see around you is the result of Rudy's contribution to this as well. Only thing that we haven't done was follow up on a suggestion that Rudy made about a year ago, which was to put a really good banner in front of this congregation. A lot of Hebrew letters, Maybe someday we'll get to that, Rudy. In the meantime, I'm just so very grateful to you for your amazing expertise and the fact that you're willing to give it to RSL Ruin. Shakal. It is my great pleasure to ask Bobby Kohler to say a few words. Bobby.
So thrilled that you're all here. I want to say some thank yous because everyone is so kind to me. They're congratulating me, but I really have to set the record straight. I certainly was bitten by this whole Yiddish bug. I do not understand Yiddish, only abyssal. I'm getting better, though, during this course, but there was something about this period and some of the liveliness, the cultural collisions that were taking place that really kind of inspired me and fascinated me. And fortunately, I had a partner in this, and that was Rudy. And the two of us, he was emailing me Yiddish websites, and we found a guy in New Jersey with Yiddish memorabilia. I mean, we're getting lost in New Jersey, and I'm saying, what the heck am I doing? And we find this guy that has all different material and sells it to us and makes it larger for us. And so one thing has led to another, and fortunately Rudy helped us organize it because this is a very sophisticated and wonderful congregation. And if we pinned it up with thumbtacks on the wall, it would look very different than the way this has been graphically designed with photographs, with identification, and the text that's so readable and it's got a black and white kind of unifying motif. He is a pro, and this looks so good because of Rudy. So he can't get enough of our help, and he with great graciousness and generosity. But he's not the only one. Rudy and I kind of pushed this along because we both have done it before. But people who haven't done it before, this is really like our services, where we don't have a cantor, but we get up and our congregants lead it. This is all done by congregants. So when you're reading things and you think it's so beautiful, I can tell you that one was done by Cynthia Brodsky in The Early Conditions. The Origins of Yiddish Theater and Abraham Goldfaden is by Barry Feldman, who has a wonderful breadth of information. The Shakespeare in Yiddish is Barbara Nadler. The Entrepreneurial Women of the Yiddish Theater was done by Diane Okrent, who also was our programming person. Irving Berlin was done by Jerry Solomon, and the last one, which is The Crossover Artist, was written by Marilyn Shapiro. So we each had topics that we researched, wrote, and not only did everybody write it well, we have people in the congregation. One wrote a grammar book, another one is a great editor, Joanne Fearman, and where is my other great friend? Alice Gosling. Yes, Alice also. Where are you? Raise your hand. Yes, thank you so much for doing editing so that it comes out sounding and reading professionally. No typos that I know so far. In addition, we worked with, fortunately, when we had this idea and we wanted to do something with Yiddish theater, what came out, Stardust Lost, The Triumph, Tragedy, and Mishigas of the Yiddish Theater in America by Stephen Kantner. Well, I emailed. I found out he was speaking on the West Side. I went and I heard he was really entertaining and knowledgeable. He was so nice, he gave me his email address. And then I said, you know, we're thinking of doing this. It's a great idea. If there's any way I can help, please let me know. He's here tonight. Another Mitch that we keep coming across, people who have been so helpful to us. Sarah Stone has done all of the arrangements for the food. All American food, right? Popcorn, hamburgers, hot dogs. Shelley Binder provided our music and also programming. We were fortunate, Laura Resnikoff knew people at the public library who loaned us this large photograph of Orchard Street that had been in the Molly Peacock show at the library. And they let us have it because the Molly Peacock show was down. And then, of course, Vicki Stein is unbelievable. She will do anything. Anthony and Lawrence, I can't believe it. I say, I think I'd like the benches. Okay, the benches appear. It's this unbelievable power. They will just try to do anything to accommodate. And last, but of course, very important, is our rabbi, Michael Schwartz, the board. They all think this is a great idea. Not every congregation does. Not everybody wants to go into a visual format. and we're really fortunate that they support this and that they feel it's a great idea. So I really have to set the record straight that this is a very communal and a community project, and I'm so glad you're here. And one thing I want to do, first I'm going to play some music because I think it kind of sums up the evening in Americanization, and then have Diane Okrent come and introduce our wonderful speaker, Stephen Cantor.
And she suggested a book. And the book she suggested was Stardust Lost by Stephen Cantor. It became our Bible, the little baby. So we are very, very honored to have the author of our Bible here tonight to speak to us. Stephen Cantor is the author of many books on a wide range of subjects. His most recent works are Stardust Lost, The History of the Jewish Theater, which I highly recommend, and The Voodoo That They Did So Well, a collection of essays and biographies about the men and women who created Broadway theater. Obviously, there was a movement from Yiddish theater right to Broadway. The author's most recent biographies, Ball of Fire, about the sources of Lucille Ball's comedy, and Groucho, concerning the life and wit of Groucho Marx, were both national bestsellers, as was The Last Empire, a social history of the De Beers Diamond Company. One of his novels, The Eighth Sin, centering on the fate of the gypsies during World War II, was the Book of the Month selection and led to an appointment on the President's Commission on the Holocaust. Stephen was a writer and critic and editor at Time magazine for more than 20 years. His articles and reviews have appeared in most major publications. He's the recipient of numerous awards, including installation as a literary lion of the New York Public Library. Currently, he's the cultural critic of the online New Leader magazine and serves on the editorial board of City Journal, a quarterly published by the Manhattan Institute. He and his wife, May, a consultant at the Early Childhood Center of Sarah Lawrence College, live in Hastings on Hudson. They have two married children, Lily, a teacher in Connecticut, and Ethan, a Manhattan-based detective. We are so honored to have you, the author of our Bible.
First time I've ever played that. Nonetheless. I just thought I'd do a few personal things. This summer I was in Amherst, Massachusetts, talking about this book. And I noticed a guy in the back row asleep. Well, if you've taught college, and I have, you're used to that. So I didn't say anything. And then when it was over, there was a Q&A. And after a couple of Q's, the mistress of ceremonies pointed at him. He said, "I want you to know I didn't hear a word you said." And she said, "Well, he had a lapel microphone, all the rest of us here." He said, "Now the rest of us ain't 92 years old. So if you don't hear me, just speak up, you know, and I'll try to be loud as well." Also, I thought I would give you a little personal background. Why did he write on this subject? My grandfather came from Iași, Romania, which is where Yiddish theaters began. And the family was involved intimately in Yiddish theater, but not as performers. They were producers. They were so-called money people, probably about $10 in our American currency now. But they were interested in it, and they ran wine bars and that sort of thing, which is where Jews went to the theater, where they didn't go to regular theater. And my grandparents, you wouldn't think, look at me, but they were little people. And I used to stay in the summers with my grandparents, who lived in Harmon, New York, which is not really upstate, but semi-rural. And there was a picture of Bertha Kalish, who was a famous Yiddish theater actress, and she was playing the witch in Hansel and Gretel. And I would not go to sleep in that room until it was turned to the wash. I was terrified. This must be really interesting theater, if it could scare a little boy like this. And so I began to ask my grandfather questions. And he was 30, I was 31 when he died, when I was about 30, and he was still very cogent, he would tell me all kinds of stories, and I taped some of them, I swore one day I would write a book about the Yiddish theater, and I kept asking publishers, and I published a lot of books, and nobody was interested. I said, "Well, you know, you're not going to sell very many, we are in the business of making money," and so on. It was a very tough sale, but after the Groucho and Ball of Fire, which got Lucille Ball, both of the bestsellers, they said, "Well, what are you going to do next?" And I said, "I want to do the Yiddish theater." "No, no, no." I said, "Yes, but I want to do the Yiddish theater. I'll give you one if you give me one." So I got to do The Stardust Lost, and they got a book called Somebody, which is about Marlon Brando. It's the biography that I just handed in. The captions are in this bag now, so I mean, I really just finished it. So that's the trade-off. But this is the book I'm proudest of because I got it done, and it was an uphill struggle all the way, and it's worth it because, you know, when I think my own kids who were interested because I was interested, and now my granddaughter, I can't get my granddaughters to watch black and white movies, much less get interested in theater. But so I thought I would really, before it melts, before it goes, and it's going fast, you know. And I remember, because I was a critic at the time, I got to meet everybody, like Walter Matthau, who had been in the Yiddish theater, and Zero, who was never in the Yiddish theater, but totally fluent in Yiddish, and who was a very naughty man. Probably the Fiddler on the Roof had the best opening night of any Broadway show ever. He was fabulous. But thereafter, he decided he could do whatever he wanted. And he used to ad-lib Yiddish in the middle of Fiddler on the Roof. And Joe Stein, who was the author, used to say, "Zero, you're supposed to be talking Yiddish through the miracle of the theater, and you're listening to it in English. But this is a shtetl, and they're talking Yiddish. If you talk Yiddish on top of the English, on top of the Yiddish, nobody will understand." He never understood that. But he had great stories about the Yiddish theater. As strangely enough, did a man who I met at the end of his life, Irving Berlin. And, you know, Irving Berlin was a poor kid from the Lower East Side, very anxious to get away from the ghetto and get out and make it in the big world, which he did. And one day, his daughter told me, Time magazine, his daughter told me that they were brought up very WASPy. Mother was Catholic, but Irving remained a proud son of a rabbi to the end, and the end was 102 years later. And he wanted these kids to behave very well, and his wife, Mary Ellen Berlin, who was wealthy in her own right once upon a time, had lost it all, and then Irving bailed out her old man, who didn't like him. In fact, he said, I want you to know my family goes all the way back to the first days of the Bible and beyond. And her father said, well, here's a quote from the Bible for you. Exodus, get out. But they married anyway. And the girls were sitting there and at the dinner table, and one had elbows on her arm. And had elbows on her arm. The mother said, get your elbows off the table. You know what? Young ladies don't do that. And well-behaved people don't do that. Get them off now. And she said, but Daddy has his elbows on the table. And she said, your father is a genius. I use that in my house, but it's pretty good. And he had a precedent, and that's why I bring this up, because he used to talk a little bit about the Yiddish theater, although I don't think it really influenced his music. He was more of a ragtime guy, and he would write about anything that his mind connected with. But he had a precedent. There was a man named Abraham Goldfaden, who really, as you know from the posters here, is the father of the Yiddish theater. There, no other theater has a father that you can name. Nobody can name who started the Elizabethan theater or the Comédie Française or the Russian theater, although there are some demigods. But we know that Abraham Goldfaden started the Yiddish theater in 1876 because he thought that the Jews of Romania, which was a fast track then, Jassy was an important industrial center, deserved a theater of their own. Up to that point, the rabbis said that the theater was frivolous, and except for Purim Spiel, it was very little. And he decided that he would try it. And it was an enormous success. The problem was that he had absolutely no vision. He had great ability. He wrote a play called Schmendrick, and the word Schmendrick is in our language now. You can find it. My cultural ardor, what Yiddish words are acceptable in a large crowd. And for that, I go, if you do the Times crossword puzzle, which I do, I occasionally find them in there. Will Shortz, who edits them, is a friend of mine. He's very proud of a whole bunch of them. I worked with him on a few because I thought some of them were, iffy. He withdrew those before they went into the Times. Anyway, Schmendrick has become a part of our language, and that's an Abraham Goldfaden character. He was very good at that sort of thing. He's very good. He had no training, like Irving Berlin, one finger on the piano. But he had a great sense of melody, Raisins and Almonds, you know, and so he wrote. It never went out of print. But his real vision was that he, or lack of vision, was that he thought that Yiddish theater's future lay in Europe. And so he stayed behind, and in this enormous crowd that came, the Kishinev massacre, all of the pogroms began to be so terrible after the assassination of the Tsar, for which the Jews were blamed, although they had nothing to do with it. And they came in floods from the Pale, and they settled on the other side, which is not only part of here. And they became the world's greatest audience. You know, you can't have a great theater without a great audience, and that was an audience starved for culture. They had never seen anything like this. Here were theaters, and they were in the heyday of the Yiddish theater, which was, say, from about 1895 to the beginning of World War I when immigration slowed to a trickle. There were 24 Yiddish theaters in New York, and some of them were as spectacular as, say, the Albany Theater. They had circular stages, they had flies, we could hide the scenery, and I'll read you a little portion of this. I don't read from mind that much, but this is the portion that's very interesting. 2,700 people at one theater, that's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And so it was enormously successful, and but Goldfaden had nothing to do with it. He was childless, but he had three spiritual sons. And you would know the name of two of them instantly. Boris Tomaszewski was almost a joke. And you know his grandson, Michael Tilson Thomas. Michael Tilson Thomas is an orchestra conductor who discovered he was Jewish about 20 years ago, and now he's very, very into it, but he wasn't for a long time, hence the name. And Boris Tomaszewski had two sons, Harry, who is Michael Tilson Thomas's father, and Teddy. By the time I got to know these guys, Teddy was about 92, and Harry was in his 80s. Teddy was a thin little wiry guy, and Harry was quite fat. And I was in Van Nuys, California, where both of them lived, and I was doing some Yiddish theater research, but more than that, I was doing research at that point on a book I wrote about the Catskills. And it turned out that Boris Tomaszewski, who became an enormously successful impresario as well as an actor, had a dot shop up there, Hunter, which is a great town in Catskill. And to show you the kind of life that these people led, he had white horses. You know, to get up the Catskills in those days, there was a railroad and then a ferry crossing, and then maybe if you were rich, an automobile, otherwise horses. He was up there, and he had made some silent movies. And he hated himself in silent movies, and he had them on a sheet, he showed them on a sheet for the guests, and threw rocks at himself. and so I was hearing all this from Harry, and he said, my brother might come today, maybe he won't, we're not speaking. I said, huh? I really are. And while we were talking, a little red convertible came up, and this very correct old man walked in. And the street door was open, he walked in and still didn't say hello to his brother. He said, he acknowledged me. And then they began talking about throwing rocks at the sheep. And I said, look, I'm taking notes frantic. I said, what year was this? He said, I think, that's for me, I'm not a... I said, I think it was 1906, because Papa's mistress that year was Mrs. Rabinowitz. And Teddy, for the first time, said, it was not, because that year, I remember distinctly, that Papa's mistress was Mrs. Moskowitz. This is the kind of life that Boris Tomchev's a very spectacular wine women song-loving guy. And I think rather shallow, but very ambitious. The second spiritual son was a man named Jacob Adler. You should know that name because he really was a great actor. I'll tell you a story about him in a minute. But he was also the father of Luther Adler, who was quite a good character actor on Broadway. And Stella Adler was the most famous acting teacher in American history and taught Marlon Brando and Meryl Streep and a whole bunch of other people. And really a wonderful teacher and wrote good books on the subject of acting. It's a tough life. And the third was a man named David Kessler, whom nobody knows much about. He was the first really naturalistic actor. There was an awful lot of bad acting, and there's the very spectacular breastfeeding and that kind of stuff. But it went down because that's what was going on Broadway, too. They weren't the only hams in the world, pastrami's, I guess, in the English theater. They're all like that. If you listen to John Barrymore, this too is so inflexible. Nobody really talks like that anymore, but they did then. So it was everybody was over the top, and David Chester was not. He was a very naturalistic actor, and he brought people back into that kind of interpretation of a real life instead of this kind of artificial, strange kind of acting, which, as a matter of fact, Kafka loved. Kafka wrote about the Yiddish theater, a little bit about it in his diaries, and he talks about how he loved this, the over the, I said, if you're far away and you're going to hit the target, you have to aim high. So that was his idea. So Kafka was right all the time. Anyway, these are the three guys who founded the Yiddish theater as we know it, and because the Jews of that Lower East Side were so almost pathetically hungry for culture, they came to everything. Boris Tomchevsky was a man who evidently had great legs, which was very important in those days because he was in tights all the time. Very well did. I mean, shop girls would swoon and give up all kinds of luxuries, even necessities, to go to see him. One day, he learned that the Jacob Adler was going to play Othello. This had never been Christmas. Very unusual to do Shakespeare on the Lower East Side. And so Boris decided he would do Hamlet. He had seen it, a production, Sir Henry Irving. He decided he would do Hamlet. He had a house hack named Hurwitz, who wrote plays, turned out once a day, practically. And he ran up to Tomaszewski and said, Tomaszewski, I'll write you a better play than this Hamlet. And Tomaszewski put on a very truncated Hamlet. I have a picture of him. It's a very Zostic Hamlet. But nonetheless, he did it. And at the end of the first performance, there was applause, and for his bows, and then came the shout, author! And his wife, Bessie, was mortified. She didn't know what to say, what to do. So she said to one of the actors who was not in the production, you go out on the paper on the stage, take a bow and say you were Shakespeare. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to say Shakespeare. So she went out and she said, Mr. Shakespeare, which they spelled S-H-E-K-S-P-I-R, so you could do the rest of it with an accent. Mr. Shakespeare lives a long way away in London and he couldn't be here. Now, you know, there's an instructive part of that story that isn't just funny, but people knew they were in the presence of something important. They knew that Shakespeare, they didn't quite understand it all, but they knew it was really something that they should know. And later, Jacob Adler, who really, really was an actor, decided that he would do Shylock. This is a very big event on Lower East Side, because Shylock is Shakespeare's most anti-Semitic creation, and there's no getting around it. It's true that he humanized things. I mean, do we not bleed? Do we tickle us? Do we not laugh? I mean, he couldn't make a two-dimensional villain because Shakespeare couldn't do a two-dimensional anything. Nevertheless, it's a very strong anti-Semitic caricature. And Adler said, no, I'm going to invest in what they did. I'm going to play it differently from the way anybody else played it. And when he did, the Broadway critics came down, they were Jewish, and most of the Broadway critics were not Jewish, they came down and could see they were in the presence of something really very, very important. And a Broadway producer came down and said, I want to bring you up to Broadway. And Adler said, look, I know what I sound like when I speak Jewish. I sound like a vaudeville Jew. In Yiddish, I'm florid and important and resonant, but I can't. And the producer said, you don't understand. We'll bring you up and you can speak Yiddish. The rest of the company will speak Elizabethan English, but you will speak Yiddish. And that's the way it was done. And it ran for a year. And I think I've tried to get the folks being and other people to do this. And I think you could put on The Merchant of Venice with Shylock in Yiddish, everybody else in English. I think it would be a fabulous production. And you could parallel it. But it's very hard to get anybody to budge on the subject. I think I'll do it one day, but I try very hard. It's difficult, I think partly because people don't, ethnicity is very strange right now, as you know from the election. I mean, everybody is, there's a lot of special pleading in the world, and that's not the way I see this. I just see this as a tribute to a great actor and also a way of making Shakespeare more relevant to audiences today. They understand that you can play it without doing the standard caricature that's been done all these years. I mean, it must have been spectacular. The write-ups are very moving when you read them. And so anyway, those are the three people that began the Yiddish theater. And then the Yiddish theater got both very commercial. There's a Yiddish word, shund, which is, you know, essentially pop garbage. And occasionally they would get confused. For example, they would put on King Lear, but they would shoehorn a song into King Lear, and there's probably a song sheet, if there isn't, you can go on the Brown University site and you can see it, and they shoehorn another song into Tolstoy's Resurrection. I mean, they were put into anything, you can watch them, they were, you know, so that was constantly being mixed with very, very serious theater. There were some extremely serious playwrights like Jacob Gordon. Jacob Gordon was the socialist who was started to write about European theater, but then realized what he had down here. What he had down here was sweatshops and the idea of organization and all that, and he became a very important playwright to the point where, in 1905, maybe a little later, Henry James, who had been living in the great American novels, had been living in England for 20 years, and he came back. He was curious. He was an anti-Semite, but he was very curious. And so he said, I want to see this. And so a friend arranged for him to meet with Jacob Gordon. Jacob Gordon had 9 children, beard, you know, very spectacularly Jewish man. Henry James, terrified of everything, master of nuance and scruple, bald, very, very different kind of man. And the two of them, they were the original odd couple. They really were. And Gordon took him to a musical. And James wrote about it later in American Notes, and he said, there was a smell not further to be followed, meaning garlic, I think. and he said, for these people, they breed like flies, and they hang like monkeys from the, and what he meant was, you know, the staircases, the fire escapes. What he never realized was that in 2 generations, these people would be worrying about their kids getting into graduate school at Harvard. He never understood the enormous ambition of the Jews to get out of the Lower East Side, and that was, in effect, the beginning of the death knell of the Yiddish theater, because, you know, the price of acceptance, of assimilation, is that you lose your Eden. You have to give up your Eden to come on. And that's what happened in the Catskills. When, you know, the air conditioner came in and people could afford to go to Miami and to California and then eventually Israel. And what happened to Lower East Side is that kids didn't want to learn the language of their parents. I mean, I know myself, the reason I know any Yiddish is because I want to know what my parents are talking about. And my parents were pretty assimilated people, but they used it as a secret language. And that's generally the case, I think, with probably thousands upon thousands of people. Yiddish has actually caught on recently, and there's a professor named Jeremy Dollar at Columbia who let me do some translations. And Yiddish at Columbia, with all of the problems Columbia has in other ways about the Middle East, is the fastest growing foreign language study. That's pretty interesting. And I think what happened is that to some extent the assimilation urge has run its course, and people are beginning to look to the roots. What is this? Where have I come from? What does this mean? And you know, Yiddish is a strange language. It's a Velcro language, I think, because it picks up as it goes along. I mean, there is no such pure, it's sort of German, but it isn't really German. It's sort of Spanish and it's Spanish. It picks up everything. And in America, all right, Nick became those are no good, Nick. Those are Yiddish terms now, because they just pick them up wherever they can. So the language is, on one hand, very welcome and warm and has its own substance. On the other hand, we all know that as proud as Isaac Bashevis Singer was, and writing in Yiddish and his Yiddish typewriter, which went the other way, I know him pretty well, but he made it because he had good translators. And he was very fluent in English, but he could not have been a Nobel laureate without having an English shadow across his work. And so to make Yiddish work again, I think you have to do it in translation. I mean, when we go to see Chekhov, you don't see Chekhov in Russian, you see Chekhov in English. It's written in Russian, but we accept it in English. And the same thing is true with almost any great play. Ibsen, you don't hear Ibsen in Norwegian, you hear it in English. And so I think there's a woman named Ellen Persman who's trying to do this, because there's an enormous backlog of Yiddish plays that nobody's ever heard of, not since the early days. And then there are two great ghost plays that, again, I keep trying to get somebody to do. One is The Duke, and the other is The Golem. These are great plays. They really are. They're every bit as stylistically horrifying as Frankenstein or Dracula. I mean, those can be camped up too, but they're really, if you look at them as tales, they're really quite pure and interesting, and they're really about science. You know that the Golem is about creation of life, but not God's creation. It's a very interesting play. It should be done, and occasionally it's sort of done off, but it isn't done right, I think. So, you know, if you ever have a chance, you might think about asking. I want to read you a little passage. First of all, people always ask me what the title comes from. And the title comes from Mark Twain, not from a Jew. And Stardust Lost, he felt referred, and I'll show you in a minute, to the Jews because his wife came from Elmira, New York, so he knew what was going on in New York State. There was a man in Seligman who was a banker, and quite obviously Jewish, who was turned down at a resort because he was Jewish. No other reason, he had plenty of money. Mark Twain was outraged, and so he wrote an essay called Concerning the Jews, and this is just a paragraph from it. He says, if statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. It suggests a nebulous, dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of. Has always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has made a marvelous fight in this world, in all the ages, and he has done it with his hands type. I'm a pretty terrific courtroom lawyer, don't you think? I just want to, there's a couple of things actually. One is just to talk a little bit about, you know, sort of what happened to the Yiddish theater. Well, the Yiddish theater, you know, went out into the world. And you probably know these names: Paul Muni, John Garfield, Zero Mostel, Walter Matthau, the acting teachers Lee Strasberg and Sanford Meisner, the playwrights Clifford Odets and Ben Hecht, the directors Harold Clurman, Sidney Lumet, still around. These are people who had experience in the Yiddish theater, but knew that there was no future for them. The only one who wouldn't leave was Sholem Secundi, another by mere bistachet. He would not leave the Yiddish theater. And one day, Boris Tomaszewski called him and he said, I hear you're terrific, and I want you to meet this other young guy who I think both of you could be terrific for me. And the other guy's name was George Gershwin. And he said, play a little. And so Sholem played a little bit. Secundi played a little bit. He said, that's very good, very good. Now, Mr. Gershwin, you play a little bit. Gershwin played, he said, not for me. So Gershwin went out, every time he would run to Sholem Secundi on Fifth Avenue and say, if it wasn't for you, I'd still be in the Yiddish theater. True story. So there's the other, there's just something I love in here because, you know, everybody had a day job except the stars, and there was a writer for them, and his name was Israel Barsky, and he had a card printed up, which I have reproduced here. It says, Israel Barsky, tailor, actor, and playwright, author of the Spanish Inquisition, pants older than press. It's my favorite business card. I don't have one for me like that. Get the can of water, pants clean and press. I want to read you, something because, you know, it was an overheated life. It really was an overheated life, these people lived. So sometimes they couldn't tell the difference between what was going on in the theater and what was going on in life. And people said, well, you know, the plays are full of coincidence, melodrama and all that, but that's what their lives were like. And you have to realize everybody lived within 7 blocks of the theater. I mean, it would be as if we were all living on 47th Street in Broadway. You know, it was inconceivable. But in those days, that's where they lived. So it was really a neighborhood theater. And the neighborhood was full of, you know, dramas of all kinds, incest, murder. I mean, the things would go on, and certainly the abuse by Jews of Jews. And, you know, who ran the sweatshops? Jews ran the sweatshops because they didn't want to pay for manufacturing. They wanted to manufacture themselves, so they had people sewing there for subsistence wages. So all of this was overheated. And I just want to read you about Boris Tomaszewski, and you'll see what I mean about coincidence, because if this were, if I wrote this in a novel, you would say, oh, come on, and Dickens could get away with it, but not now, but this is all true. At times, Boris Tomaszewski's intensity carried over from the stage into family life, with consequences that matched anything on the stage. The most melodramatic of them occurred when his adolescent sister acted alongside him. Emma was a comely girl, very well developed for her age. Half the men in the company fell in love with her, but she refused their advances. Boris assumed that Emma was saving herself for marriage and then made a shocking discovery. His sister had been secretly carrying on with a director who had brought Boris back to New York. Not only has this middle-aged Romanian emigre been married before, he had a son somewhere in Europe, abandoned at the time of the divorce. The Tomaszewski descended on Emma and forced her to break off the liaison in a very public manner. Boris selected an evening when the Thalia Theater was SRO. All 2,700 seats. See what that's like, 2,700 seats. Were taken as he stepped before the curtain at the second act intermission. Ticket holders were advised to stay in place following the finale. There would be a shvir. A shvir was sort of an ancient rite, you don't hear of it very much. But according to tradition, life-changing vows were to be taken in public before a meeting. And the 2,700 would be another way of our name. We have here tonight 10 times 10 million Boris boomed before exiting to the wings. The audience buzzed. What did the great Tomaszewski need with 10 times 10 million? Someone guessed correctly. The Lower East Side, after all, was like a small town where Shondas were the lubricant of life. Others found out soon enough. After the last act, the curtain rose on two Tomaszewskis, brother and sister. The actor played the real scene as he played all fictive ones for maximum effect. Before this audience, before God, do you swear? He asked his intimidated sister. I swear, she said, trembling before the onlookers, that you will never go out with a man named Morris Finkel. That I will never go out with a man named Morris Finkel. Or ever see him or have any dealings with him again as long as you live. She had trouble getting the words out. Or ever see him or have any dealings with him as long as I live. The audience responded with an immense ovation. Women wept, who called an admiring witness. Emma's eyes were dry, but everybody shook her hand. It's for the best, Emma Child. An old man and a young girl, it never works. You have been saved for some great love, which will come to you when you are truly a woman. The public humiliation was too much for Emma. That night, she sewed off Big Rod and ran off with him. But that's not the end of the story. They ended their journey in Philadelphia, where the newlyweds founded a small Yiddish theater. Over the next decade, the Finkels had three children and went about their business. In time, Boris grudgingly made an uneasy peace with his brother-in-law, and Emma was invited to appear in her brother's productions. The Finkels relocated to the Lower East Side. Trouble began a year later when Emma was cast opposite David Levinson, a good-looking, rather withdrawn leading man. If drama was what Boris had in mind, he was about to get it in overplus. The couple began to meet on the sly. Emma introduced David to her children, and they could not keep the secret from her father, from their father. Finkel confronted his wife. She admitted, yes, she had fallen in love. She wanted a divorce. He refused. There was too much at stake here. He reminded her, there must be a cooling off period in which Emma and David would stay far away from each other. Passion must give reason a chance. She gave in, took the children to a rented farmhouse in Old Bridge, New Jersey, and resolved to think things out. Several weeks later, during a family outing in the woods, Emma looked up to see her lover impulsively walking up a path. David and Emma embraced, held hands, and strolled in the dappled sunshine. The little boy and his sisters ran ahead. A voice rang out behind the couple. They looked back to see the drunken Morris aiming a pistol at them. He had followed his rival from Manhattan. A trigger was pulled. A bullet whizzed harmlessly by David and split the wood of a nearby tree trunk. Emma gave a galvanic twitch, turning around to see if the children were out of range, just as Morris fired again. The shot intended for the man hit the woman instead. Emma fell unconscious. Morris certainly had slain his wife, turned the gun on himself, and fired once more. Death was instantaneous. The children retained memories of their father's body being carted off, their mother also being carried away, but the ambulance took her to a hospital at the morgue. She would never walk again. Misery upon misery followed the shooting. At first, Levinson moved in with his crippled amour, acting as surrogate father to the trio of bereft children. The Yiddish proverb, the world is a wheel and it turns, had special relevance a few years later when the burden proved insupportable. David abandoned Emma for a younger woman. Boris gave his sister enough money to live on, yet found it impossible to forgive her for breaking that long-held vow and for bringing ruin on herself. But he would not punish the next generation. He found a place in his productions for Emma's prettiest child, Bella Finkel. Early in the rehearsal of the musical, the girl was introduced to her leading man. She found him irresistible. 2 years later, she married Muni Weisenfreund. He would become better known by his stage name. Now, I tell you, if I wrote that as a novel, I would be hooted at out of town. But it's a true story. Every word of it is true. All the coincidence, all the violence, it was all part of what it was like to be a Jew on the Lower East Side, to be ambitious, to be artistic, to want to succeed, to want to get on in America, not to lose your Jewishness, but the push-pull is always, it's always been a tightrope act, and it's I think more so in theater than in most of us, because the theater itself is you know, what Lee Strasberg once called lies like truth. Harold Cornman uses it as a title. And it's true, the theater is lies like truth, but when you know that if you go to the theater, for the first 3 or 4 minutes, you say, oh, it's the asbestos curtain and the painted scenery on, you forget your own life. And you look at the theater, and that's what these people did all the time. And they did it until after World War I, when, first of all, there was an enormous wave of anti-Semitism in America, Red Scare and all that. All Jews were considered to be Bolsheviks. And then, strangely enough, it was survived briefly because there was a theater at Cummings that called Artef, which produced some very interesting plays. Of course, they had no stars because, you know, it's communism, everybody's equal. So. But there was a star painter and did backdrops, and Boris Aronson, who did the first set for Fiddler on the Roof, and was an amazing artist, really amazing. And he had a career outside, but the rest of them did not. And then there was a man named Maurice Schwartz. And Maurice Schwartz was the last great impresario. He had something called the Yiddish Art Theater, which survived until the very early 50s. And he had heart trouble and he died in Israel, still trying to get his theater started again. And that was sort of the end of it. And I would be exaggerating if I said the Yiddish Theater had much life in it. Now, there is the Volksbühne, but the Volksbühne, which does super titles, essentially does musicals. And in my view, that's about one third of the Yiddish Theater. Yiddish Theater is good in its way sometimes, as Tolstoy is. And certainly, when it's funny as New Sun. And I think that it needs revival, but it needs revival in English. And that's probably the way it's going to happen, whether we like it or not. I think Yiddish will be learned, and it'll be learned in college, but it's artificial. You know, it's like learning in Latin. It's a language that survives because it has enormous vitality, but it doesn't survive as a language, as you know or should know. In Israel, they forbade it the first few years of Israel's existence. And when everybody learned Hebrew, they thought that, just the way the Tsar did, that Yiddish was jargon, that was not to be tolerated, but they gave it after a while because of too many people who spoke Yiddish and tradespeople, it became impossible to put it down. In any case, that's where the Yiddish theater is today, and my feeling has always been that you can't kill art. There's something about the survival, you can't, the way the Jews are, we Jews are a saving remnant. We haven't had the service that our grandparents did, or people who survivors of the Holocaust, with whom I have a lot of intellectual commerce, but we all survive because there is that beat of life in all of us, and this is a good testimony, not only the synagogue, but the fact that so many of you have turned out. Jews turn out for Carnegie Hall, they turn out for the Metropolitan Museum, they turn out for Lincoln Center. Without Jews, there is no culture in New York, and without Jews, there is no New York, which is, I think, why you were bombed on 9/11, because the radical Islamics thought that there's a Jewish city. In any case, I want to just, before I get to Q&A, I want to tell a story because I think it's relevant to this. In Oxford, before World War I, just the way people dressed for dinner, had tuxedos every night, ladies had gowns every night, if you were above a certain class. And in Oxford, they wore cap and gowns every day to go to class. So it was pretty obvious who was and who wasn't a student at Oxford. And the war was raging. 1916, and an old lady in a bombazine came up to one of these young men, tall, smacked him with an umbrella and said, "Young man, what are you doing to save civilization?" He said, "Madam, I am civilization." Well, you are civilization. You people who care enough to carry on the intellectual and the cultural work, curiosity, the intensity that any of you will have, you will be here, provide a civilization in which the rest of us just sort of, you know, without you there is no writing, no books, and no music, and no lyrics, and there's no Broadway, and there's no libraries, and all the rest of it. So it's not you that should applaud me, I should applaud you, and I do.
And no, Maurice Schwartz went to Buenos Aires too.
Yes, there was a Yiddish theater in Buenos Aires.
Does it survive today?
Yes, it does, but it's small. It's strange. There are places where they were more, in Buenos Aires during the war, there were more Nazis than any place outside of Germany, there were more Jews in Yiddish theater, same place, Buenos Aires. A very strange occurrence that happened there. And there were still, there are quite a few. It's not like, I think you know there was a synagogue bombed in Buenos Aires about 10 years ago. There's a very strong and vibrant Jewish community. It does keep us going. Sir.
I just wanted to tell you there is one Hebrew day school that they teach Yiddish. And this is the only Hebrew non-religious day school.
Where?
Kinneret.
Uh-huh. And
my kids.
Can you repeat the comment?
That they teach Yiddish, Hebrew, and English.
No, I was just talking about the fact that it's so rare that you can find a Hebrew school that teaches Yiddish. There's one. I don't know that one. But you can certainly learn Yiddish. First of all, you're on your own, and every time I go into Grand Central, there's one of those places where you get a tape that teach you Yiddish. But also, there was a time when Yiddish was kept alive on WEVD. Do you remember that radio station? They would try to get very American, and the announcer would say, my mother had a show on WEVD, so I know pretty well this. That was amazing. WEVD, the station that speaks your language.
I'm just going to say there is still a Yiddish paper that's being read. It's called the Far Book. It's also being read in English and Russian. And that Orthodox Jews are still translating into Yiddish, and they speak Yiddish among themselves.
Yes.
And even in Israel, they have begun to say that Yiddish is not something that Jews use.
That's right. But the Yiddish forward is
tiny, but let's not brush it away.
Not brush it away, but when they started printing the forward in English, you knew what was occurring. Yes.
Since you also wrote a book about the Catskills,
yes.
And I actually had played music up in the Catskills in the 60s during the heyday, can you talk about the correlation between Yiddish theater and then the Catskills and sort of the movement of people from Second Avenue up to the Catskills?
Well, the Catskills used the vaudevillian part of the Yiddish theater. I mean, they did not. There were very few. They kept trying to do serious Yiddish theater. It never worked. There was one resort which was intellectually inclined. The rest were not. So what you had there was largely the tumblers. And they made the jump. I mean, Jerry Lewis could make the jump quickly. Sid Caesar could make the jump quickly because they were Jewish. But I always thought that was Yiddish body language. You know, they didn't really speak in any. It was later on that Johnny Carson, or the beginning, Henny Young would use a little Yiddish, a storyteller named Myron Cohen, you remember him? He would do that kind of great dialogue. That's another thing, I've been down, when my grandmother retired, she went to Miami, and I used to go down there so I could get the accents. And remember Mel Brooks, 2,000-year-old man?
Those days was already a good job,
And that, you don't hear that accent. It's just gone. I think that kind of immigrant is no longer with us. There are these Russian immigrants, that's true. The ones you're talking about can read the Russian language forward. And the Volksbühne has super titles in Russian because the Russian Jews are just trying to find themselves. I mean, they were deprived for so long. You hear that accent, but that's a very different accent from the accent beyond the pale, I said, that kind of thing that they are. I mean, my grandfather didn't have it because he was Romanian, but that kind of accent that people kid around about and all the stories that, two Jews go into a bar, that kind of stuff, that's gone. It's just gone. I'm too old for that. Yes.
Which hotel would you identify as the intellectual hotel?
It's a woman named Anne, I forgot her last name. People would know it's a communist hotel. I mean, not Orthodox communist, but it was a Marxist hotel. And the rooms were named things like the Karl Marx room. That was where you went if you wanted to be intellectual. By the way, I think the chef is saying that I wanted nothing to do with it. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.